The Old Testament scriptures, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, were written for our benefit and for our instruction, and according to Romans 15 and verse 4, that we might gain encouragement from those things. That's really the perspective that I'd like to look at this story, this historical account of the life of Samson. And so today, we'll be in Judges chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16, which is the only place in the Old Testament that Samson is discussed. He has just four chapters in the book of Judges. And I want to do a brief overview of his origin, his life, his downfall, and his redemption. But I want us to be asking ourselves, as we're thinking and considering this man, Samson, what lesson or lessons can we learn from the account of this judge in our life today? So with that, let's begin looking at this man, Samson, and his life. Samson is an interesting choice for a judge, in my opinion. After all, the judges were the people that God would raise up from among Israel to lead his people back to him, to deliver them from the oppression or the bondage of foreign nations that had come in and were tormenting them. Really, when you look at many of the judges, though, as you read through the book of Judges, you start to realize that most of the judges are pretty interesting and, in my opinion, unlikely candidates for judges. It seems odd that God chose these guys to be the deliverers of his people. And I think that especially is punctuated with Samson. Samson was a man's man. Samson was strong. Samson was confident. Samson was the kind of guy that he wouldn't take any gruff from anybody. Nobody was going to wrong Samson and not hear about it. Samson was the kind of guy who handled himself well in a fight. You didn't want to pick one with him. Samson was also a womanizer. In fact, typically we're going to see that Samson was pretty carnally minded in his pursuits and his actions. From our perspective, he seems like, as I said, an unlikely choice to be a judge or deliverer of God's people. But I think something that sheds a little bit of light on why God would have chosen a man like Samson is when we consider the spiritual state of Israel at this point in their history. Now, anybody who's looked at the book of Judges knows that there is a cycle of repetition in the book of Judges, where God's people enjoy a period of prosperity and peace, and then they turn their hearts away from God and begin to serve other gods. They get embroiled in idolatry, and they go away from God. And so God delivers them over to an oppressor, some foreign entity that comes in and either captures them or steals from them or subjugates them or something. And then when times get bad enough, God's people would cry out to God for deliverance, for mercy. And unlike some of us as parents, we might say, well, you got yourself into that mess, get yourself out. God looked with love and compassion upon his people, and he has mercy, and he would always raise up a judge or a deliverer who he would then use to conquer the enemy and bring peace to the people. And they would enjoy that peace for a while, but after a bit, they would forget about God again, get embroiled in idolatry, and the whole cycle would start over. And by the time Samson comes onto the scene, they've been through this cycle many, many times. And so it really shouldn't surprise us that God has to use less than ideal deliverers. You know, there are several characters, doubtful Gideon. How did he get picked to be a judge? Or cowardly Barak, who said, I'm not going to go unless this woman goes with me, with Deborah. You know, and so I think when God got to the time of using Samson, in my opinion, God is scraping the bottom of the barrel, trying to find somebody to deliver his people. And so we see in Judges chapter 13, the origin of Samson. He's actually born to a husband and wife who are of the tribe of Dan. They are old. She has been barren. And that means she's never had any kids. And the angel of the Lord comes to her and says, you're going to have a child. And this child, this son, is going to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistine oppressors. Now, what's interesting is that the angel tells her that he is to be a Nazarite from his birth. And so if you're with me there in Judges chapter 1, notice verse 3. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said, behold, now you're barren, you've borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now, therefore, be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. For behold, you're to conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. Now, what's interesting is this idea of a Nazarite. We actually go back to Numbers chapter 6, verses 2 through 21, that talks about all of the laws and the customs that were pertaining to this law of the Nazarite. But a Nazarite essentially was one who had been set apart or consecrated themselves to God for a specific purpose. In fact, the Hebrew word that's translated in most of the English translations as Nazarite simply means a consecrated one. Or it has an alternate or variant rendering that could mean untrimmed, as in a vine being untrimmed or undressed. Well, that's fitting because if you look in Numbers chapter 6 and you start noting all of these requirements of one who's going to take this special vow of consecration, one of the things that they weren't allowed to do was they weren't allowed to drink any wine or strong drink. In fact, they weren't allowed to consume anything that had been produced from the grapevine. Well, remember that word means untrimmed, as in a vine. Leave it alone. Well, don't have any fruit of the vine. Don't consume any of it in your life. Another thing is, they weren't allowed to cut their hair. Well, untrimmed again. You don't dress it. You don't clip it. You don't prune it. You don't keep it looking neat. You just let it grow. And part of their vow was that as long as they were under their vow, they were to continue to let their hair grow as long as it would. Furthermore, the Nazarite, while he was under his vow, was not allowed to make himself unclean by a dead body. That means he couldn't touch anything that had been killed or dead. Even if his mother or his father or his brother or his sister died, he wasn't allowed to touch their body to take care of his dead relative to bury them. If he did, that would have been breaking his vow. In fact, it's interesting, there's a whole bunch of verses there in Numbers chapter 6 that talk about, well, what if somebody died next to him suddenly and fell on him? What does he do? Well, he's got to offer all these sacrifices to make atonement for breaking his vow. He has to shave his head and he has to start all over. Keep that point tucked in your mind as we go through with the story of Samson here today. But then at the end of the vow, he would offer these ritualistic sacrifices to God. He had fulfilled his vow. He had fulfilled his time that he promised, I'm going to set myself aside for you, God. And once he offered those sacrifices, his vow was over. Now, the interesting thing about Samson, though, is that Samson was to be a Nazarite from his birth, even unto his death. So he's a little bit unique as a Nazarite, that his vow wasn't just for a week, or for a month, or even for a year. It was for his entire life. Which means, really, Samson's vow was not one that he took of his own free will. That is, it wasn't of his volition that he decided he would be a Nazarite dedicated to God. It was something that God commanded that he would be. And so he was informed about that by his parents, even as he was young and growing up, that he had been dedicated to God for his service, for his purpose, for all of his life. And we read there after his birth in Judges chapter 13, verses 24 and 25, that the woman gave birth to the son, named him Samson, and the child grew up, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Manahen Dan, which is the camp of Dan, between Zoar and Eshtol. So that's the beginning of this judge of Israel, Samson. As we begin to look at the early life of Samson, we start seeing that he's a real interesting character. Right there in chapter 14, we have the account of his marriage to a woman in Timnah. And the story begins by him taking a trip down to Timnah. From Zorah to Timnah was about 7 miles. And what you need to understand, and the kids that were in my class, remember on the map where we showed where Philistia was, where the Philistines lived, Dan, the tribe of Dan, bordered right on the land of the Philistines. And Zoar was just a couple miles on the east side of the border. Timnah was just a couple miles on the west side of the border. And so basically, we have Samson taking a stroll, a long walk, and he's walking from Zorah to Timnah. And we read there in verse 1 that he went down to Timnah into the land of the Philistines, and he saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. And so he came back and told his father and his mother. He says, I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. And his father and his mother said, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among our people that you have to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she looks good to me. So he travels down to Timnah, and this chick catches his eye. She looks good to him. He is smitten by her. And he wants her. And as a young man, why not? Well, she was a less than ideal suitor for Samson. Notice that when he comes to his parents, their first thought is, why can't you get somebody from among your own people? Why do you have to go to the Philistines to find a wife? Because not only was this woman a foreigner, but notice, she was of the people who were presently persecuting and oppressing the Israelite people. She's not just a foreigner, she is the enemy. And mom and dad say, can't you find somebody who is better for you than this daughter of the enemy? And Samson says, she looks good. I want her. And so his parents travel with him, and he goes down making presumably several visits down to this woman's family to negotiate the marriage. And on one of these trips, Samson is attacked by a lion. We read in verse 5, Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring toward him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that he tore him as one tears a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. So they went down, they talked to the woman, and notice again, verse 7, she looked good to Samson. Verse 8, when he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass, that is the dead body of the lion, and behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the body of the lion. So he scraped the honey into his hand and went on eating as he went. And when he came to his father and his mother, he gave some to them and they ate. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey out of the body of the lion. Now, understand this. There was nothing wrong with killing the lion, right? In fact, King David, you remember when before he becomes king, when he's a young shepherd and he goes out to the armies and Saul is the king. And there's that giant of the Philistines, by the way, Goliath, taunting the armies of Israel. And David says, I'll go out and fight him. And Saul says, no, you're too young, you can't do it. And David says, why not? When I was out shepherding the flock of my father, at one point a bear came up, and at another point a lion came up. And what did I do? Well, I chased it, and I grabbed it, and I killed it to protect the sheep. There's nothing wrong with killing a lion. Even though a lion, by the way, would have been considered an unclean animal. You go back to Leviticus chapter 11, we're told there, I think it's in verse 27, that anything that walks on paws, a four-footed animal, that it's to be considered unclean, and you're not, and this is the important part, you're not to touch its carcass. Now, there's a difference between a live animal and the carcass of an animal, isn't there? A carcass is a dead animal. And here's where we start to run into some problems with Samson in relationship to this lion. So he comes across the carcass, and inside the carcass some bees have made a hive and they produce some honey. And so he reaches in there and he scoops that honey and some of the honeycomb out of that lion, out of the carcass. And he eats of it. That is at best a very questionable thing to do. Honey in itself is clean, but it came out of the carcass of an unclean animal. And as a Nazirite, you weren't supposed to touch or make yourself unclean by something that was dead. And so here we have the Nazirite, a Jew, scraping honey out of an unclean dead animal and eating that. And what's worse, he gives to his parents and they eat of it, but he doesn't tell them where it came from. Now, if it's true that it made him unclean when he ate of it, he would have made his parents unclean as well by giving it to them. And they would have not even known that they had violated the law. So we have that interesting incident. But that's not why we're told this account of the lion. The lion's going to come up in a minute because of Samson's riddle. But we begin here in chapter 14 and we begin to see this cycle of revenge. And it starts at his wedding. As was customary, they would have a feast for about 7 days, and the Philistines bring 30 companions to be with him to celebrate his marriage to this beautiful girl from Timnah. And Samson proposes a riddle to them. He says in verse 12, "Let me now propound a riddle to you. If you will indeed tell it to me within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I'll give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. But if you are unable to tell it, then you shall give me 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes." And they said, "Well, that sounds like a good idea. Tell us your riddle." And so here's this riddle, verse 14. "Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet." And for 4 days, they can't figure it out. And so they tell his wife, his new bride, they say, "Listen, you need to find out the answer to this riddle. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? So that we can have stuff stolen from us?" Because they're realizing if they don't solve this thing, they're each going to have to give him a change of clothes. Which, that was worth a lot of money and value to people in the ancient world, a whole change of clothes. And so they threaten his wife, and they say, "If you don't find it out, we're going to burn you, and we're going to burn your father's house down." And so now she's on a mission. She's got to find out the answer to this riddle. And so she begs him, and she pleads him, and she plays on his heartstrings, and she says, "Oh, if you love me, you would tell me the riddle. You haven't told me." And I love his answer. He says, "Listen, I haven't even told my folks. Why would I tell you?" But she nags him, and she nags him, and she nags him. And for 7 days, the whole feast, I think, she's asking him, and finally he can't take it anymore. And so, in verse 17, on the seventh day, he told her because she pressed him so hard. And what does she do? Immediately she goes and tells the guys that were at the feast. And they come to him and they say to him, "What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion?" Verse 18. And I like Samson's response. "If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have known the answer to my riddle." Guys, don't call your wife a heifer. But that's what Samson is saying. "You stole the answer from me by taking it from my wife." And he's enraged. He's mad. So you know what he does? He goes from there down to Ashkelon, which is a major city of the Philistines. It's on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. It's a port city, and he kills 30 Philistines from that city and strips them of their clothes and takes them back to his wedding feast, and he throws the clothes down. He says, "There you go." He makes good on his part of the bargain. And he's enraged, and his anger burns, and he goes back to his mom and dad's house. Goes back to Zorah, leaving his new bride behind. And so, because his father-in-law thinks that he's so mad at his new bride that he has just abandoned her in his rage, he decides, "I got to do something with this daughter of mine. I'll go ahead and give her to the guy that was best man in the wedding." And so in verse 20, Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. But, chapter 15, verse 1, after a while, Samson cools down. He comes back to visit his wife, to go into her. When he's about to go into her bedroom, the father-in-law says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, what are you doing?" He says, "I'm going to be with my wife. What do you think I'm doing?" He says, "You can't do that. I thought you had abandoned her. I thought you had rejected her. And so I married her off to your friend." And Samson says, "Oh, you did that to me? Well, now I'll be guiltless for this next thing I'm going to do to you." And he goes out and he catches a bunch of foxes. And he ties the foxes' tails together, two foxes' tails together, ties a torch in there, lights the torches on fire, and lets the foxes loose in the field of the Philistines, burning down all of their crops. Well, the Philistines are a little bit ticked about that. And so they come and they say, "Who did this?" Well, it's told him. "It's that son-in-law of the Timnite, Samson, he did it." So what do the Philistines do? They make good on that original promise to his bride and father-in-law. They come and burn them alive. Well, now Samson's really ticked. And so he takes vengeance on the Philistines. Again, we read in verse 7, he says, "Samson said, 'Since you act like this, I will surely take revenge on you, and after that I'll quit.' And he struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter. And he went down and lived in the cleft of the rock at Edom, which is in Judah. And so the Philistines gather up their army, and they go and they camp outside of this city in Judah, in Lehi. Now, the residents of Lehi are like, "What in the world is this Philistine army doing here? What are we going to do?" And they find out they're not here after us. They're here after Samson. So they go. I think it says 3,000 of them in verse 11. They go down to the cleft of the rock of Edom, and they say to Samson, basically, "Listen, we've got to turn you over to the Philistines because we don't want to fight with them." So Samson says, "Well, listen, as long as you promise not to kill me, I'll go peacefully with you." So they bind him with two new ropes. Say, "We won't kill you, we'll just hand you over to them." They bind him with the ropes and they take him to the Philistines. And the Philistines are getting all excited and happy. "Yes, we've captured our enemy." And as soon as he's turned over to the Philistines, boom, he busts out of those ropes. And what does he see? He sees a jawbone of a donkey laying there. He picks it up. And with the jawbone of a donkey, he slaughters 1,000 men. Verse 16, "With the jawbone of donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of donkey, I have killed 1,000 men," Samson sings. He's rejoicing. So Samson, every time he encounters the Philistines, he just whoops up on them. And I think that he starts to get a little bit cocky in his attitude. And so when we get to chapter 16, we start to really see the downfall of Samson. You'll notice in verses 1 through 3 that Samson has this liaison with a harlot, with a prostitute. But notice where it's at. Samson went to Gaza, which is like the capital city of the Philistines. He goes into the belly of the beast. He goes into the heart of enemy territory, and he says, "You know what? I'm here and I'm going to have a good time." And he goes into a prostitute. And they think, "We'll take advantage of him while his pants are down," literally speaking. And they're going to lay wait for him. They're going to capture him. Well, in the middle of the night, Samson wakes up at midnight. They've locked the doors of the city. They've got him trapped. They've got him wrapped up in there. There's no way he can escape. Well, Samson grabs that door and he doesn't just rip the door off the hinges. He rips the door frame and the door post and the door off of the wall of the city, and he throws it on his back, and he marches in the middle of the night from there over to the mountain next to Hebron, which Hebron and Gaza are about 40 miles apart as the crow flies. And he carries the gates of the city up to the top of the mountain and puts them down there. Now, I think if anything, this story illustrates both Samson's cockiness, that he thinks, "I can do whatever I want, nobody can touch me," but also his carnality. He's thinking about things from a fleshly perspective and what brings him pleasure. But it also serves to illustrate his great strength, which could only be a result of God blessing him. God is the one who gave him this great strength. And then we have probably the most familiar story of Samson and Delilah. Samson meets another woman. He falls in love with her. By the way, the Valley of Sorek is also in the land of the Philistines, and so the implication is that she too is a foreigner of the Philistines. And he's shacking up with Delilah, and the lords of the Philistines come to Delilah and say, listen, we've got to do something about Samson. We will pay you handsomely if you will find out what his weakness is. We've got to get rid of him. And so we know the story. Three times she asks him, you know, if you love me, you'll tell me what your weakness is. Don't you love me, hon? Please just tell me. And three times Samson gives her a story. The first time, you know, it's that if you bind me with, let me look at my notes here. If you bind me with seven fresh cords the first time that have never been dried, then I become weak like any other man. The second time it was, if you bind me tightly with new ropes that have never been used on anything else, then I'll be like any other man. The third time, if you weave my hair into the loom, like a loom that you use to make fabric, if you weave it in there and then lock it in with the pin, then I'll become weak like any other man. And so every time that Samson tells Delilah one of these stories, she does exactly that. She binds him with the seven ropes. She binds him with the two ropes. She weaves his hair into the loom and puts the pin in there. And every time when Samson, she's doing this while he's asleep. And after she's got the trap set, she cries out, Samson, behold, the Philistines, they're upon you. And every time Samson wakes up and he busts those ropes off or he pulls his hair out and he just whoops those Philistines. And notice in verse 15, then she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You've deceived me these three times and not told me where your great strength is. So she presses him daily with her words, and she urges him that his soul was annoyed to death. And finally, he caves and he tells her. He says, I'm a Nazarite. The razor's never touched my head. If you shave my head, I'll become weak like any other man. Does his caving here sound familiar to you? It's not the first time a woman has nagged him until his soul was annoyed to death, where he gave up a valuable secret. But you know what's interesting to me about this account here? What I've often wondered as I've read it, why was it so easy for Samson to lie so easily to this woman that he supposedly loves? And not just once, not just twice, but at least three times that are recorded for us, Samson just flat out lies to her face. And he seems to do it with rather ease. How could that be? Well, perhaps it was that Samson wasn't really in love with this woman. That is, he didn't really love her. Perhaps Samson was just in lust with this woman. Perhaps she too looked good to him. And so he was thinking visually. And it wasn't real love that he felt for Delilah, but rather it was infatuation. And he saw Delilah not as a valuable human being with a soul, but he saw her as an object, as a tool. And her use was to gratify his flesh. And as long as she made him happy, he loved her. Loved. That's looking pretty shallowly at Samson. Another option is that perhaps it illustrates another crucial flaw in his character. He was just a liar. He just wasn't an honest person. Or perhaps, maybe you can relate to this more, he had a hard time opening himself up to other people. Maybe he had difficulty really trusting others. Maybe he didn't really know what it was like to be in a real relationship with somebody. Maybe he was scared to be vulnerable in front of somebody else. And so he's always holding everybody at arm's length away, never really confiding in them, never really opening himself up to them, never really being real until they nag him to death. Either way, it's a character flaw in the man Samson. But once she pries the truth out of him, when he can't take it anymore, he falls asleep that night. She shaves his head. She cries out, "The Philistines are upon you." Samson wakes up thinking it's going to be like every other time. I'm just going to whoop these guys and go back to bed. And then he realizes, wait a minute, my strength has left me. And they capture him. And they gouge out his eyes. And they take him and they make him a prisoner and put him to grinding in a jail, bound in bronze shackles, back there in Gaza, in their capital. I don't know, but to me, this is maybe I'm just being too critical of Samson now, but he seems like a real dense guy. Like, why was he surprised that all of a sudden his strength had failed? He knew he told Delilah what his real weakness was. He knew that every other time he had told her a fib, she did exactly what he told her. He knew that the Philistines were hiding in her apartment because night after night she's going, "The Philistines are upon you!" And he'd wake up and he'd whoop them and go back to bed. Did he not see that one coming? Well, he's not going to see anything anymore because they gouged out his eyes. And then we get to Samson's redemption, which is still there in the 16th chapter. We don't know how long he had been in prison, but at some point the Philistine lords are gathered together having a celebration, and they call to have Samson brought out so that he can entertain them. And really what it is that they're giving their god Dagon credit for the capture of Samson. You know, it's as if they're saying, "Behold, the great persecutor of the Philistines, the champion of Israel, that blind, wretched, bald guy there." And they're making fun of him. And they're making sport of him. And he's there to be the entertainment at this dinner party. And on that occasion, Samson turns to the Lord at least one time. In verse 28, Samson called to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me just this time, O God, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistine for my two eyes." Even in his appeal to God, I see some carnality and selfishness. He recognized God was the source of his strength. And he recognized if he was going to be strong enough, it was going to be because God gave it to him. But he's still thinking of himself. "Let me be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. Let me pay them back one more time for what they've done to me." And so God grants his request. He's been led to the center pillars of the building in which all of these Philistines are gathered, and on top of which are all these Philistine spectators. And he bends with all of his strength, putting his weight on those two pillars, and he pushes them down, and the whole building collapses. And we read that the dead whom he killed at his death, verse 30, were more than those whom he killed in his life. And then his brothers and all his father's household came down, took him, brought him up, and buried him between Zorah and Eshcol in the tomb of Manoah his father. Thus he had judged Israel 20 years. Now, if that's all that we were told of Samson, we might think to ourselves that he died as he lived, by himself and for himself. And even if that were the case, even if Samson was just a carnal, selfish, worldly guy that only thought about himself, I think there's still a lesson here that we can learn about our God. The key is actually in Judges chapter 14 and in verse 4. You remember back at the beginning, he sees that Philistine woman. He looks at her. She looks good. He wants her for his wife. He goes to his mom and dad and says, "Get her for me. I want her." And they say, "Can't you find somebody from your people? Do you have to go to the Philistines?" Notice what it says in verse 4. "However, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for the Lord was seeking an occasion against the Philistines." Because now at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. What I would suggest to you is this was all we knew of Samson. A carnally minded, worldly, womanizing man's man. God can even use those kinds of people who don't acknowledge him, who don't care about him, who don't serve him really, aren't interested in serving him. God can still use those people to bring about his plan. You know, if God can use Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians to come in and carry out his judgment against Israel, he can use anybody. He certainly uses Samson. And sometimes God will use us even when we're kicking and screaming and fighting against him. But let me suggest to you this, that even though God can use you in your rebellion against him, though God's plan and purpose will be fulfilled, your plan, your purpose will not. Your purpose is to seek and serve God. And God can use you even if you refuse to do that. But you won't benefit from it. In the end, you will still be lost. But let me share with you real quickly, in our last few minutes, a different perspective on Samson. There's only one other time that Samson is mentioned in all of the Bible outside of Judges 13 through 16. And it's in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 11. If you're unfamiliar with Hebrews chapter 11, it's sometimes referred to as the heroes of faith. We read in verse 1 and 2, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the men of old gained approval." And then the Hebrew writer launches in to this great list of all of these heroes of faith from the Old Testament. He talks about Abel. And he talks about Enoch, and he talks about Noah, and he talks about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. He talks about Moses. And then he gets down to verse 32 and he says, "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon," that's one of the judges, "and Barak," that's that guy I told you wouldn't go into battle without Deborah, "Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets." Notice verse 38. "Men of whom the world was not worthy." How in the world did Samson get his name on this list? The implication is that Samson, too, was one of these men of old who, by faith, gained the approval of God. And I would suggest to you there's a couple of lessons that we could learn from that. One is a lesson we can learn about our God. That when God looks at us, his people, he sees our faith and not our failures. By our estimation, Samson was a failure as a spiritual man. But I would suggest to you that at least at the end, he had a real, genuine faith in God. And so God chose to look at his faith and not his many failures. There's no doubt that Samson was far from perfect. He was selfish. He was carnal. He was self-seeking, he was vengeful, he was moody, he was dishonest. But apparently, at least at the end, he also was a man of real faith in God. And that's what God chooses to remember about Samson. Perhaps it was those days, whether they were few or many, working at the grinding wheel in that jail in Gaza, without his eyes, finally, unable to look at the world around him, to be captivated or distracted by some fancy thing over here or some beautiful thing over there. And in the darkness, he was finally able to look inward at himself, and he saw himself for what he really was. I don't think it's a coincidence that the story starts out with, "She looks good to me." And now at the end, nothing looks good because he can't see anything. There in the dark, when all he could look at was himself, and into his heart he saw his own faults, he saw his own errors, he saw his failures, and he realized that God was the one, the only one, who gave him strength ever. And so, having been humbled in this way, he finally turned himself over in faith to his God. Maybe we need to shut our eyes and look in at our hearts and see our faults and our shortcomings so that we'll be humbled to turn ourselves over in faith to the strength which only God supplies. Perhaps you can relate to Samson. Perhaps you've been living your life for yourself, pursuing whatever catches your eye and looks good to you. Perhaps you've taken the blessings of God in your life for granted, maybe even taking advantage or abusing those gifts that He's entrusted to you. Maybe you've been scared of pursuing true, deep, and abiding relationships with others. Perhaps you've always held everyone at an arm's length because you are too afraid to be vulnerable in front of anyone. Perhaps you, like Samson, have consistently chosen your companions poorly. And so instead of choosing to be around and associate with people who will build you up and bring you closer to God, you've chosen to be with people who always are drawing you away from Him. The good news is, as long as you have breath in your body, it's not too late to turn in genuine faith to God. Recognize your error. Repent of it and humbly submit yourselves under His mighty hand. And I pray that it doesn't take physical blindness to get you to look in at your heart, to see what and who you really need in your life. What will you learn from Samson?